You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 25th of March, 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Will blaming Ukraine for Friday's terrorist attack by Islamic State spare President Vladimir Putin from Russia's people blaming him? A Security Council resolution for a Gaza ceasefire at the umpteenth time of trying, but will it make a difference? And the political perils of attempting to appear polite while abroad. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Terry Stiastny and Stephen Diel, will discuss today's big stories. Plus, we'll meet the people behind a project to give a voice to Yemen's forgotten war. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily, and I'm Andrew Muller, and we will start here in the UK, where Parliament has been briefed on actual and possible cyber warfare being waged against the country by China. Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden says China has launched an attack on the Electoral Commission generally, as well as upon specific MPs with a record of being critical of Beijing. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, meanwhile, has described China as the greatest state-based challenge to the UK's national security. President Xi Jinping being taken for a pint in a Buckinghamshire pub by then Prime Minister David Cameron seems a lot longer than 9 years ago. I'm joined with more on this by Nina Dos Santos, international broadcast correspondent, former CNN Europe editor. Nina, first of all, specifically, what is China being accused of here?
Well, China's been accused of hacking essentially into the Electoral Commission database. So this is the record of all of the registered voters across the UK, and that could have compromised the security of 40 million people across the UK. So they could have got hold of their names, addresses and other sensitive data. And also separately, in another attack, they're being accused of having hacked into the email accounts of targeted MPs who've been very hawkish on China and quite vocal about that subject for a number of years. Remember that there's a lot more hawks on the Conservative side of the House of Commons. And as a result, Rishi Sunak has been under a lot of pressure to get a tougher stance together on China from them. And this has come quite quickly, many people will have said, especially at a time when his party is very fractious and we're heading towards the election later on in the year.
Well, that right there, it strikes me, may be a partial answer to the question of why they're making a thing of this now, because quite a few of these go back some while. The attack, alleged attack on the Electoral Commission was a good few years ago. Is it possible that the Tories have grasped that maybe teeing off at China might help them lose this next election by slightly less than they're obviously going to?
Well, obviously, it'll be a rallying cry to those sort of irksome backbenchers who've been very, very vocal against Rishi Sunak's stewardship. Remember that there were some calls just a few weeks ago for some MPs to put in letters of no confidence to try and replace Rishi Sunak, perhaps with the likes of Penny Wardant and other candidates who appear to be better loved by the further right elements of the party. But, you know, today I went to a press conference where a couple of these MPs spoke out about some of the issues that they've been having with China. A number of them, remember, have actually been sanctioned by China about 3 years ago. That means that they can't travel to China, and neither can members of their families. Some of them who might have been doing business in China can't go there anymore. This is what one of them, Tim Lawton, had to say about the exact types of things he's had to deal with over the last few years.
Intimidation of family members and intimidation of Chinese dissidents who have family members from Xinjiang, from Tibet or whatever, who've been threatened because they've associated with us and so on. It's not been easy for the last 3 years since we've been sanctioned, but I think it's been a recruiting sergeant for people waking up to the fact that China is a malign force and poses a serious threat.
So that's Tim Lawton, just one of a number of MPs, four in fact, including one member of the House of Lords, who are summoned by the security authorities, you know, in charge of security in Parliament to a meeting earlier today to give them an early briefing on what the government appears to have announced today. So What is China's response to this? Well, China has said that it always has firmly fought against all forms of cyber attacks according to the law, and it doesn't encourage or condone or support any forms of cyber attacks as a government. It says that it calls these allegations completely fabricated and malicious slanders. The UK has now summoned the Chinese ambassador to explain what has happened here, and they've also put two specific named hackers on a sanctions list, as well as a technology front company too. Now, many of these people, as I was saying before, who are members of the Conservative Party, who have been specifically warned that they have been targeted by cyber attacking campaigns, will say that that goes nowhere near enough, but it is at least a step in the right direction, they say, for the UK to get tougher on China, when other countries like Canada and the United States already have dozens of people on sanctions lists at this point, Andrew.
So what do the MPs targeted actually want done about this?
Well, what they want is a much, much tougher stance on China. One of them, Tim Lawton, who you just heard from there before, was saying, you know, this isn't just about money. He, in fact, pulled out some data saying, look, every time that, you know, we get easier on China, we don't actually end up doing more trade with them, the United Kingdom being the we in that point. He says that, you know, actually, when there was the so-called Sino-Golden Era that David Cameron ushered in, you remember when he was Prime Minister and brought Xi Jinping here for that famous pint in his local pub that you're referring to in your introduction, he said that actually, you know, trade wasn't as robust as it was in later years. What they want to see is a much more aggressive decoupling from the Chinese economic machine. That could be convenient to the UK, let's face it, at the moment, because the Chinese economy isn't doing as well as it has done during the times when David Cameron was trying so hard to court China. And they also want, you know, a much, much more robust stance on human rights, particularly with regards to what's happening in Xinjiang and also Hong Kong. Lots of these MPs in particular speak out about Hong Kong and their concerns over more draconian laws that are being passed there. In fact, I was speaking to another one of those MPs, you know, who has been subject to a lot of cyber attacks and harassment, Stuart MacDonald, who's a member of the Scottish National Party. Here's what he said about how he thinks the discussion and the relationship between the UK and China should be reframed from here.
You know, any sanctions or moves that they announce today will be welcome, but in and of itself will not be enough. We need a new, modern, updated strategy that parks into history the golden era. There's no way to keep that thing breathing, and I think that's too often what the government tries to do, and move into a something that is much more in line with other Western European countries, which is deal with China as it is.
That was Stuart MacDonald, MP, at the end of that interview with Nina Dos Santos. And listening to that was today's Daily Panel. Terry Stiassny, the political journalist and author, and the Russia analyst, Stephen Diel. Terry, first of all, what do you make of, well, the final abandonment there of the golden era of less than a decade ago? Is the UK's government gone all China hawk just out of electoral expediency, or do they realise that, well, that basically a change of tack is necessary because trying to be friendly with China has not worked?
Well, I think it's really interesting that the person who is having to do the change of tack here is David Cameron, the former Prime Minister, the former person who invited, you know, the Chinese for a pint in the pub. And right at the moment, he is due to be speaking to Conservative backbench MPs who are going to give him a pretty hard time about this because, you know, he was the orchestrator of the original strategy. Some of the MPs already saying these sanctions are derived. They're a feeble response. It's taken too long not to do enough. So I think he's going to be under a lot of pressure to sort of U-turn even further and to try and make the rest of these MPs happy. And many of them, including one of the other former prime ministers, Liz Truss, are the kind of people you want.
Stephen, we will be talking more about Russia very, very shortly. But has something of the experience of the Russia policy going violently askew in the last couple of years caused a rethink of how we approach China, which is not Russia, but many of the challenges are similar, i.e. this is a country very unlike a Western European democracy. It does not share those values for right or for wrong. And possibly we have to get used to the idea that trying to envelop them in any kind of economic relationship is not going to make them ultimately more amenable.
I think there's a direct link between the Russia policy and the China policy. there were those of us banging drums for many years saying, you know, to take a closer look at Russian business in the City of London, when a lot of people were making, a lot of British people were making a lot of money out of it. And anything that was a bit nasty, like the killing of Litvinenko in 2006, even the start of the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014, were rather pushed to the background, and really not, the attention wasn't given to them. And we know that Russians are expert in hacking as well. So that there's a definite link there. You know, oh, it's the Chinese hackers. Oh, well, yeah, you know. I just find it staggering that there was any time a golden era of relations with China, particularly as recently as 9 years ago, because if anyone had seen what they really were capable of doing and what they wanted to do and that they're opposition to Western democracy, they should never have been in bed with them in the first place.
Well, to Russia now, where President Vladimir Putin thereof is still attempting to find ways to blame Friday's terrorist attack on a Moscow theatre on Ukraine, despite a convincingly sourced claim of responsibility by Islamic State and the arrest and apparent torture of four suspects from Tajikistan. Neither Putin's mood nor his credibility are enhanced by reminders that earlier this month, US intelligence services warned Russia, publicly as well as privately, that an attack of this kind was likely. A concert such as Friday's was even cited as a likely target. Stephen, first of all, as somebody who, you know, lived in Russia, reported from Russia, knows Russia and Russians quite well, there's a couple of related questions I'd just like you to address quite quickly. One is, how widely understood will it be in Russia that on March the 7th, the US did issue this warning saying we have intelligence, extremist elements are likely to attack large public gatherings in Russia? And if they are aware of that, how likely is anybody to buy Putin's attempt to pin this on Ukraine?
Sadly, not enough Russians will be aware of that, because one thing which Putin's regime has done pretty successfully for the majority of the population is close down access to information from outside Russia. The younger generation, those who are a bit more tech savvy, have downloaded a VPN and can get Western information. But first of all, they won't know, and therefore many Russians.
You would only know this if you went looking for it. TASS was not leading its bulletins with US warns of.
Indeed, it was not. And so the idea that this is now a sort of false flag by Putin, say, oh, you know, it's all Ukraine's fault. Unfortunately, there's a significant percentage of the Russian population who will believe that, particularly that sort of probably 25% who believe that Putin really did get 87% of the vote recently in the presidential election. So he, in that sense, he's got some time on his hand, on his side in Russia itself, that there won't be vast numbers of people crying out and saying, hang on, but you ignored the intelligence from the Americans. Also, he personally cannot believe that the Americans would have done this, would have given information to a country they regard as an enemy, even if it was about a country that both, or an organization that both regard as an enemy. He could never imagine himself doing that. If he knew of a terrorist attack coming in America, the last person he would tell would be the American president.
Did Putin commit, do we think, Terry, that elementary error of blowing off information because he didn't like, well, he was judging the information by the source, not the source by the information?
I think that does seem likely. As Stephen said, that seems exactly the kind of way that Putin would think about this, that, you know, why are they telling me this? What do they mean by it? They can't possibly just genuinely be trying to help me out here, you know, even though the Americans, you know, the French have also been quite worried about this as well. You know, even if they're getting it from multiple sources, it sounds like they would just think, oh, they're just doing that to try and scare me or to try and, you know, upset me and some way. But that's the trouble. If you get into that sort of dictatorial mindset where most of the time people are out to get you, you're not likely to believe it when they tell you something that might genuinely be helpful.
I mean, Stephen, how do you see Putin reacting to this? Because given what we know of how he governs, he will feel obliged to react. He will feel necessary to make a demonstration of force at someone or something. It may well be just an escalation in Ukraine, and I don't mean to use the word just there in a glib fashion, but he's already escalated in Ukraine. He has already attacked Ukraine for absolutely no reason at all. Is it beyond imagining that he might feel it necessary or justifiable to make some sort of demonstration against Tajikistan?
I would very much doubt he'd go for Tajikistan, particularly having come out and blamed Ukraine. I can see one way in which, of course, he could go after Ukraine in a bigger way, which would be using a tactical nuclear missile. I think that's unlikely. But I think there will be more. You know, we saw at the weekend this past, we saw two massive missile and drone attacks on Ukraine. Those may be stepped up, the number of those. What we've seen recently is they'll go on for a few days and then there's a gap of maybe a few weeks and then they start again. That may be stepped up. But of course, the West will keep crying foul. As you say, he has to do something, because actually amongst those Russian people who do stop and think about it, he's really in a situation where, you know, he has become the single ruler of the country.
Mm.
And therefore, if something goes very wrong, like happened on Friday night at this concert, who's to blame? Well, if you're responsible for everything, you're the guy in charge, there will be those Russians thinking, you know, why didn't our security services, intelligence services, pick this up, particularly as if they know that they were given information and intelligence by the Americans? So he will feel that he's got to do something to cover up that idea and stop people thinking, you know, oh, well, he let us down on this occasion. These are the sort of things that do actually worry him, because, as I've said many times before, the thing that worries Putin most of all is not the West, it's not Ukraine, it's not a nuclear war, it's an uprising from the Russian people. And the more incidents like this that happen where they say, well, he didn't protect us, the more possibility, I'm not saying likelihood, but the possibility that it's a sort of drip, drip, drip situation which could eventually lead to some sort of unrest.
Terry, just finally on this one, you mentioned there as well that France had warned about the prospect of an attack like this. Do we, and by we I mean those of us in Europe, have to resign ourselves to the likelihood that Islamic State, tempting though and delightful in fact though it would be to believe this, has not entirely gone away? France has raised its terror warning to the highest possible level, which means armed troops back on the streets again. Obviously, France has concerns ahead of the Olympic Games coming up in a few months, and there are, of course, the European Football Championships in Germany this year. We can't really zone out of this, can we?
No, we can't, given exactly. I mean, Emmanuel Macron was saying today, you know, this group has also tried to commit several actions on our own soil. They seem to be aware of you know, potential plots going on, and obviously, you know, after the Bataclan, they are, you know, very, very worried about this. And as you say, with the Olympics coming up, the European elections, there was an attack in Cologne that was foiled. You know, these kind of things could be going on in Western Europe again, and let's hope not.
Well, at the United Nations today, after nearly 6 months of war in Gaza and nearly as long of pettifogging wrangling, the Security Council has at last passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, along with the equally immediate release of all hostages held by Hamas since their attack on Israel last October 7th. The United States, which has vetoed previous such resolutions, abstained from the vote on this one, allowing it to pass. The US has insisted that this is not a shift in policy towards Israel as such, though Israel appears to be reading it as exactly that. An Israeli delegation that was due at the White House this week has now cancelled the visit. Terry, this kind of is a shift in policy, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. You know, move from the US to just abstain. This has gone through. OK, you know, Russia attempted to amend the resolution to get it to say permanent, but the other countries weren't having that. So, yes, gradually, the position is shifting. And I think it's interesting that although, you know, some of Netanyahu's advisers who are supposed to go to Washington aren't going to go, the Israeli defense secretary is already going to go, and he's there and is having meetings which seem to be carrying on. So, you know, yes, there definitely is a shift there.
A UN Security Council resolution, Stephen, is not, in theory, the kind of thing you can laugh off like you do a General Assembly resolution. This is supposed to be the court of final appeal, if you like. This is supposed to be legally binding. So do we understand what now happens if Israel just ploughs on?
Whether the UN can try and persuade its members to have some sort of sanctions against Israel, I really don't know. I mean, I've become very sceptical about the UN and particularly the Security Council in the last 2 years, because I fail to see how you can have someone who's a permanent member, i.e. Russia, mm-hmm. who's started a war for no reason at all. So I think that as a result of that, and it's not just me, the United Nations has lost a great deal of its credibility, and there will be a lot of people saying, okay, Security Council issued this resolution. Will it have any effect? You know, if Israel turns around and says, well, you know, we've got our plans and we're going to carry them out. The Americans behind the scenes, of course, will be talking to Israel and trying to persuade them to change their behavior in Gaza. But I'm afraid I've become very skeptical about the UN and particularly the Security Council.
I'm just wondering, Terry, if there might be a subtext to how the United States has played this in the expectation that Israel may attempt to plough on regardless. Is it possible that their abstention was intended to be read as a yellow card before the United States does the obviously drastic thing of actually voting against Israel on the Security Council?
It could be. I mean, it's quite interesting looking at what the US ambassador to the United Nations said after this vote. So, you know, she was saying, well, look, we're still trying to get the ceasefire. We're still trying to get hostage release. We're still trying to get humanitarian assistance in. So she was making slightly more sort of compromising noises, I suppose, and as well still criticising Russia and China because she's saying, you know, they wouldn't condemn Hamas. And, you know, so there seems to be a bit more movement there. And obviously everyone's been trying to get this ceasefire. People said, we're going to try and get a ceasefire by the beginning of Ramadan. Now they're trying to get something in place for, you know, what remains of Ramadan, but it's obviously going slower than people would like. But you get the sense there is maybe something shifting behind the scenes.
Well, Stephen, on the subject of things happening behind the scenes, the United States are, of course, communicating today's events in punctiliously proper diplomatic language, but it's hard to avoid, is it not, the suspicion that behind the scenes, this US administration in general, Joe Biden in particular, have now edged into that fraction of the spectrum between furious and incandescent.
Yes. I mean, as Terry said, you know, that this is, you know, they may go to the next step. Or indeed, you said, sorry, I think, that they may go to the next step of actually voting against Israel. Mm. They are getting that. The Americans are getting that way because they have always been Israel's greatest supporter. And there have been times in the past where people have raised an eyebrow because of the Americans' attitude, where they've really stuck behind Israel. And I think it seems that much of the world now is questioning the way that Israel is behaving and its plans to carry on in Gaza. And now there's a story that's come out today about Israelis who are already licking their lips and rubbing their hands and seeing territory they can build houses on in Gaza. I think public opinion, shall we say, around the world, and possibly going that way in America as well, is actually more and more against what Israel is doing. Behind the scenes, yes, definitely the Americans are pushing them. If they don't get any response, then they may well become totally incandescent.
Well, staying with the current US administration, it is usually wise when travelling abroad as a representative of your nation to adopt a default setting of politeness. You are in culturally and linguistically unfamiliar territory, under close scrutiny, and you don't want to get caught rolling your eyes at some or other ritual which, however tedious and baffling it may be to you, is of immense importance to the folks who live there. Such was the calculation very possibly made by US Vice President Kamala Harris on a recent visit to Puerto Rico, where she clapped enthusiastically along to a tune by local singers. Until informed that it was in fact a protest song addressing various perfidies of American policy. Terry, Vice President Harris has been the subject of an amount of mockery over this. And on the one hand, fair enough, she's the Vice President of the United States. She can take a bit of teasing. But on the other hand, it's not really fair that she's getting belted for this, is she? Is it, rather? What else is she supposed to do? She is representing the US. Well, I don't know if Puerto Rico entirely counts as abroad, but she's representing the United States. She is confronted by local singers singing a tune. It sounds cheerful and upbeat. She is clearly unfamiliar with the language, and that's not necessarily a criticism either. So she decides to sort of clap along and look cheerful.
I think that's what you do, unless you actually understood it, unless you actually thought of... and then even if you did understand it, what would you do? If you suddenly go, they're really
start
jeering
booing.
Me, you just go, right, I understand you, I've got that. You know, do you point at them and look angry about it? You probably would have to carry on in it with a slightly awkward smile anyway. So I think, you know, that does go with the territory and, you know, these kind of gaffes happen. But I think you often actually get worse ones when politicians do try to speak a different language or mm-hmm. when they do understand a different language. And some of the best ones come from their attempts to speak something else. I remember, I think it was Tony Blair who told the French Prime Minister that he loved him or something like that when he was just trying to say, you know, we get along very well, and he suggested something far more intimate. You know,
so they famously, Australia's Prime Minister of the 1980s, Bob Hawke, once addressed a Japanese gathering and lapsed into the Australian colloquialism, said he wasn't here to play silly buggers, which was rendered by his somewhat bewildered interpreter as the Prime Minister is not here to play laughing homosexuals. Stephen, have you ever found yourself, while operating abroad, misconstruing some sort of situation?
I don't think I have, but what I would like to say is that as soon as I heard this story, a name came back from the past. A name of American vice president, that one being Dan Quayle.
Oh, him.
The vice president from 1989 to 1993. Before he made his first visit to Latin America, he came out with the wonderful line, "Ah, gee, I wish now I'd learned Latin in school."
He was one of those people, though, it was never entirely possible to tell whether he was trying to be funny.
But on this occasion, he wasn't, apparently. Apparently, he thought they spoke Latin.
Terry, have you ever found yourself sort of clapping awkwardly along to something, or at least... I have... on more than one occasion been subjected to a variety of what you might think of as local dancing, at which point you do develop a frankly unfamiliar degree of sympathy with the late Duke of Edinburgh, because you just have to sit there looking absolutely enraptured without once whispering to anybody else, "God, how much bloody more of this is there?"
I can't remember any specific times when I've been sort of involved in those, but yeah, you do as a reporter tend to, you know, be standing there when some, you know, parade is going by. I remember going to the Love Parade. That was kind of different there. That was Berlin, and there was this massive, you know, rave, which was the Love Parade, which was so loud, and you could sort of hear it from absolute streets away, and trying to record that while sort of everybody is absolutely off their heads raving, that was quite hard.
Well, indeed so. Terry Stiastny and Stephen Diehl, thank you both for appearing on today's Daily. And finally, on the show, this week marks 9 years since the start of Yemen's civil war. To mark the occasion, the New Humanitarian has released what it is calling the Yemen Listening Project, a batch of some 100 recordings of ordinary Yemenis describing their daily life and experiences through nearly a decade of conflict. Monocle's Chris Chermak spoke with the project's two coordinators, Annie Slemrod and Nuha Al-Janid.
My name is Annie Slemrod. I am Middle East editor at the New Humanitarian, which is a nonprofit newsroom that covers humanitarian crises and the aid industry. And I'm director of the Yemen Listening Project.
I'm Nuha Al-Janid from Yemen. I am the project coordinator for the Yemen Listening Project with the New Humanitarian Organization. And I've been coordinating this project for the last couple of months with the organization. Personally, I'm a mother of a young child, 3 years old, and I'm living in the Netherlands as a refugee. And yeah, professionally, I'm also a human resources advisor. I met with Annie and she shared with me this idea about the project, and I felt really excited about it because it touched something inside me and a suffering that I've also been through as a Yemeni. It started last year in June. Yeah, with a simple question, how has the war impacted Yemeni's life?
It's been really important to me from the start, I should say, that this project is done with Yemenis, you know, using Yemeni capacity and makes sense as a project in Yemen. And I feel like, I don't know if Nuha agrees, but the first time that we met, we sort of got it. We were like, yes, we can do this together.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so we set out trying to think of how we can reach people really where they're at. So we set up a dedicated Yemeni WhatsApp line because Nuha told me, you know, that's really how a lot of Yemenis communicate, manned by Nuha. So people could send in voice notes, messages, really whatever.
اسمي زيد. أنا من صنعاء. بدأت الحرب وانقطعت. My name is Zaid. I'm in Sana'a. It took a few years of war and for the government to stop paying public employees before I realized that life and work was not going to return to normal. I decided to develop new skills in languages, communication, and negotiation.
When we put out this call asking for stories, we did emphasize that we didn't, even though we're asking about the war, we're not just asking for sad stories. You know, this is your story and you can tell it however you want and whatever you want. And so we got poems, we got sort of one story that's written like a short story, maybe two. And we also got, yeah, a real mix of subjects. There were a lot of stories that are just about things that I think if you don't know a lot about Yemen, you wouldn't realize become such an issue in your daily life.
Despair was beginning to knock me down. I considered going to the front lines of the war to fight. I didn't really want to fight, but I did want to die.
Lots of people who wanted to talk about the struggles they had and the success they had in completing their education despite the war. A lot of people spoke about blocked roads, which is a major issue that, you know, again, probably wouldn't come through unless you live in Yemen. Basically, it's become extremely hard to get somewhere that, you know, should take an hour, it can take a day, which can get in the way of access to healthcare or seeing family. And yeah, there were a lot of stories of, I would say, persistence in the face of what seems to me just really impossible circumstances.
Finally, there was an offer and a contract. A job in the humanitarian field, trying to ease the burden of the war on other people. I felt hard work and fate had done their jobs. I am now in a place where I can help others.
اسمي ضحى وأنا أسكن في عمان. أستيقظ كل يوم في عمان. My name is ضحى and I am in عمان. I wake up every day in عمان, the capital of Jordan, and ask myself, where to next year? But we have been here in Jordan for 8.5 years. And the 9th.
Of course, I can resonate to her story. I've been here for 6 years in the Netherlands. I'm a citizen now, but not really feeling the feeling of belonging yet. I feel myself that I'm already a tree that has been taken, from its soil, its environment, its air, and being brought up to another place. It's already a big tree. It's not yet a seed. So this is not my soil. This is not my air. I'm just being brought up here, but I don't feel the feeling of belonging. And yes, I'm integrated, but I still feel disconnected. Disconnected to my old personality, old life, and also not connected to my current one. It's a mixed of feelings.
But we still tell ourselves that next year we will return to our city. But the war doesn't stop. So here we are, still waiting.
But I have a child now, and I always tell her that she's Yemeni. And I try to raise her in a way that she doesn't forget that she has original identity, which is Yemeni. And I'm proud of that. I know that more people like me are feeling the same thing. The survival guilt as well is something that most of Yemenis who are outside Yemen feels it for a long time and suffers from it.
I have not married because I'm waiting to go back to Yemen. Dreaming about small luxuries or stability like that has stopped. Because perhaps the next moment will be the one when we return.
Working in this project was a bittersweet for me because it brought up also memories back, and I could relate myself to so many of those stories that I've heard. I could suffer from them as well, because when I heard some stories, I couldn't stop crying and got this PTSD again. It was like a deja vu. You live again. So the personal hope that I would really say is hope for Yemen is only peace. I would really love to see my country healthy, happy, living in peace again, because each and every individual in Yemen hopes for that, regardless of any other problems or conflicts that they're having with each other. So peace and only peace for me. And I would always advocate for that.
That was Annie Slemrod and Nuha Al-Junaid of the Yemen Listening Project. You can hear more clips from the Listening Project on tomorrow's episode of The Briefing at noon right here on Monocle Radio. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Terry Stiastny and Stephen Diel, also to Nina Dos Santos at the top of the show. The show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.